From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, travels through the evangelical subculture. We talk with Randall Baumer. He grew up in that subculture, but left it when he began studying the history of religion. He returned to document it for his book and the PBS series, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory. He was both impressed and disturbed by what he found. Also today, building this country's first nursing home designed for people with AIDS. We talk with Betsy Lieberman, Executive Director of AIDS Housing of Washington in Washington State. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new war memoir, Love and Rutabaga, by Claire Shu Accomando. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Warren Christopher's trip to the Middle East this weekend is still on, despite mounting violence and an unexpected call back to Washington for a meeting with President Clinton. The president said he's still hopeful Arab-Israeli peace talks can go forward despite the violence between Israel and Lebanon, and he praised Syria for showing restraint. Barry Schweid has more.
The Christopher trip is on, even with escalating violence in the Middle East, and in two ways because of it. The idea is to not let terrorism control U.S. foreign policy. Also, to keep the peace process alive is the only alternative to violence. Hezbollah, the militant party of God, is considered by U.S. officials the primary cause of the fighting across the border between Israel and Lebanon, and the Clinton administration is blaming Iran, Hezbollah's chief sponsor, while urging Syria to cut off supplies to the radical group. Syria has held its fire despite six Syrian deaths, and for that, President Clinton and his senior aides are grateful. At the same time, Syria is not being blamed publicly for the Hezbollah attacks on Israeli troops that touched off the new outbreak. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
The House has passed a $3 billion relief package for victims of the flooding in the Midwest. The measure passed on a vote of 400-27. The measure had been stalled by Republicans and conservative Democrats, who insisted that the spending be offset by cuts in other programs. The biggest share of the spending, nearly $2 billion, will go for direct aid to flood victims and to cover crop losses. The package must still be passed by the Senate, where the argument over how to pay for it is expected to continue. The levees held in Kansas City as the Kansas River crested at 19 feet above flood stage today. The Missouri River is expected to crest there soon. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
The Kansas and Missouri rivers converge at Kansas City. Both rivers have flooded low-lying areas upstream from here, but large levees designed to contain a 500-year flood kept the water from doing widespread damage in Kansas City. Army Corps of Engineers spokesperson George Hanley says the worst of the flooding may be over on the Kansas River, but he says the Missouri could still cause problems.
We still have the problem of the Missouri River passing very large flows through Kansas City and coming very close to the top of at least one levee unit.
Hanley says the Missouri should crest sometime tonight, but more heavy rain along the upper Missouri or the Kansas River could push the waters right up to the top of the levees again. For National Public Radio, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 2 points to close at 3,565.5. Declining issues led advances by a slight margin. This is NPR News. Reports from Italy say that a car bomb is suspected in an explosion that killed at least two people today in Milan. Two strong explosions were also reported in Rome. The area where the explosions occurred have been cordoned off so that ambulances and firefighting equipment can get through. In late May, a car bomb killed five people in Florence and badly damaged the Uffizi Museum. The Italian government blamed that explosion on the mafia. Today, the National Academy of Sciences released a major new study of Agent Orange, a controversial herbicide sprayed in Vietnam. The study concludes that five rare cancers and skin diseases are linked to herbicide exposure, but it doesn't find a link to most diseases Vietnam vets have blamed on Agent Orange. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Vietnam veterans have blamed a wide variety of diseases on Agent Orange. But to date, the government has only compensated those veterans who have two rare cancers and one rare skin condition. The National Academy study found that two other rare conditions are also unusually common among civilian workers who have been exposed to large quantities of herbicides for a long time. The report could not determine whether Agent Orange used in Vietnam actually caused any cases of those diseases in veterans. But today, the VA announced it's giving Vietnam veterans the benefit of the doubt for those two additional diseases, the cancer Hodgkin's disease and a skin condition called porphyria cutanea tarda. That move will affect just a handful of veterans. But veterans groups say they are encouraged by the Academy report because it also recommends further study of Agent Orange in veterans. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
IBM said today it posted an $8 billion loss in the second quarter. The giant computer maker said the loss includes a huge charge for restructuring that includes early retirement for 50,000 workers. The company said it expects to eliminate another 35,000 jobs. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Randall Baumer, has written what he describes as a travelogue into the evangelical subculture in America. He says he wrote his book neither to vilify nor to vindicate American evangelicalism, but to better understand it. His book, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, has just been published in paperback. It was the companion text to a recent public TV series of the same name. His travels took him to a megachurch in California with roots in the Jesus movement of the early 70s, a Bible Institute in Portland, a Billy Graham crusade in Central Park, a Pentecostal congregation in Georgia, and a camp meeting in Florida. Baumer is a product of the evangelical subculture. His father is a fundamentalist preacher. But Baumer left fundamentalism when he went to college. He now teaches American religious history at Barnard College. He says that people like him who are raised in fundamentalist families don't experience the powerful conversion that people raised outside the fold do.
That realization came to me actually in the course of writing the book, visiting a Bible camp up in upstate New York in the Adirondack Mountains called Word of Life. I began to see myself for the first time, began to recognize the kind of struggles that I had gone through as an adolescent as I was watching other adolescents do that. I think it's very difficult for the children of evangelical parents to claim the faith for their own because evangelicalism demands or expects a kind of dramatic conversion experience. They wouldn't always say that they demand that, but I think more often than not there is that expectation that your conversion will be dramatic. But if you have been socialized in the church, in Sunday school, vacation Bible school, Bible camp all of your life, then at, say, early adolescence, you're asked to have this conversion experience, it really doesn't have much power over you because all you're doing is simply ratifying the lifestyle that you've been taught all along. And I think it's very difficult for children of evangelical parents to appropriate the faith, or at least the fervency of the faith that they think they should.
Did you have a conversion or a born-again experience?
I did, but again, it lacked the power that I thought it should have. And so I went through this whole series, which I think is very, very familiar and even predictable with evangelical kids, where you have that initial conversion experience, but then you have subsequent experiences that they call rededication. I'm rededicating my life to Christ. And I think what's happening in that instance is that the kids are saying, it didn't really take the first time because I didn't hear bells and whistles and it didn't grip me as I think it should have. And so I'm going to try again and again and again. And I think finally many adolescents, and I think myself included, begin to throw up their arms and abandon the faith in despair.
Let's talk a little bit about your travels through the evangelical subculture. That's the basis of your book. You write that there actually is a whole subculture that kind of started after 1925 of churches, denominations, Bible camps, seminaries, publishing houses, mission societies. What happened in 1925 that was a turning point in the creation of a subculture?
The turning point was, symbolically at least, the Scopes trial down in Dayton, Tennessee. The Scopes trial persuaded evangelicals that the larger culture had turned against them, had become hostile to them and to their interests. H.L. Mencken, who led the contingent of journalists covering the Scopes trial, the monkey trial, by the way, the trial, of course, was a trial of John T. Scopes, a biology teacher in Tennessee, who was tried and, in fact, convicted of violating the Butler Act, which prohibited the teaching of evolution in the public schools. The coverage of that trial really was relentless and merciless in its portrayal of evangelicals and fundamentalists as uneducated, backwards country bumpkins. And Mencken and others held up fundamentalists to ridicule, public ridicule. And I think what that did for evangelicals was it persuaded them that the larger culture was no longer hospitable to their interests. What happens then after 1925, and really for about a 50-year period until 1975, is that evangelicals, fundamentalists, retreated into what I call a subculture, their own little world. They begin their own congregations, their own denominations, as you said, publishing houses, mission societies, Bible camps, Bible institutes, and so forth. So it was possible, actually, and I'm a living proof of this, in the middle decades of the 20th century to grow up within this hermetically sealed universe of evangelicalism, what I call the evangelical subculture. It was very much a defensive posture against what were seen as the assaults of the wider world that was both corrupt and corrupting.
You say until 1975, what changed in 75?
Well, I think, again, symbolically, I pin this on the presidential campaign of Jimmy Carter, who was, after all, a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher. And he begins to bring evangelicals out of their subculture and to engage them in the broader world, the broader culture. Now, of course, evangelicals turned against Carter 4 years later in 1980 in favor of Ronald Reagan. But Carter begins to bring them out. He brought fashion and currency to the term born again, for example, which is one of the touchstones of evangelicalism. And evangelicals began to see that, yes, we can engage in this broader culture. We needn't be quite so defensive as we have been for the previous half century.
A lot of the denominations that you visited for My Nights Have Seen the Glory were led by people who apparently had a lot of charisma and were able to attract a lot of followers. You actually think that the evangelical churches seem to be particularly susceptible to the cult of personality. Why do you think that's so?
I think so. It has to do with the nature and the structure of evangelicalism, and that goes back in turn to the 16th century with Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. Luther came up with this notion, it was his reading of the scripture that led him to it, this notion of the priesthood of all believers, that is, that each individual is responsible for herself or himself before God. And this, I think, has led to a kind of individualism in evangelicalism that, combined with American individualism, the kind of rugged pioneer spirit and so forth, has given American evangelicalism a unique and distinctive stamp. American evangelical churches, for the most part, don't have denominational or kind of bureaucratic hierarchies dictating the behavior or the comportment of individual ministers or individual congregations. They don't have creeds that tie them together. Most of them, at least, don't. They don't have any of the other kind of structural elements that you see in, say, Lutheranism or Presbyterian Church, that is, mainline Presbyterianism, the Roman Catholic Church, the Episcopal Church. Rather, individual congregations tend to galvanize around a charismatic leader, and it does lead, I think, far too often and tragically to what I call a cult of personality among evangelicals.
You say that not only is the evangelical church particularly susceptible to charismatic personalities, but now that you find a lot of the churches are just being really changed by televangelists. Not that televangelists lead all the churches, but a lot of people almost act as if they're on TV.
Oh, absolutely. That, again, that was one of the things that I found rather startling in the course of my travels. I had grown up within an evangelicalism that was largely suspicious of media, largely suspicious of some of the advertising strategies and the slickness that one associates with, say, Madison Avenue. But in the course of my travels, what I found almost everywhere in all the churches that I attended was that evangelicalism had adopted these strategies for their own use.
Which strategies?
Well, let me give you an example. One was applause. Almost everywhere I went, congregations on Sunday morning would punctuate the morning service with applause. Now, again, when I was growing up with an evangelicalism 20, 30 years ago, that would be unheard of. But now it's just a regular thing. And what my analogy and what I think is happening here is that the congregation sees itself less as participants than as a kind of studio audience, say for The Tonight Show or something like this. Another innovation, of course, as you mentioned, would be television itself. Again, many of the evangelical churches are packaging entertainment for their congregations rather than traditional or more traditional forms of worship, again, that I was used to growing up 20 or 30 years ago.
What kind of entertainment? Singers?
Singers, orchestras, a lot of canned backup music and that sort of thing. And these performers would get up on the platform or the stage. I think it's really a stage. And gyrate and perform for the audience.
What was it like for you when you'd be in the studio audience, so to speak, at a church meeting? Would you applaud along with everybody else, even though it was a real alien feeling for you?
I didn't. I think for the most part I didn't, because I guess I find it so appalling, at least aesthetically. Now, there are two types of applause, let me hasten to add. I mean, there's the applause you find in, say, a Pentecostal worship service or in an African-American church, which is definitely a participatory act, and that, I think, is very different than simply providing a round of applause after a prayer. Sometimes that actually happens, or a musical number, and no, I didn't.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Randall Balmer. He's the author of the book Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, A Journey into the Evangelical Subculture in America. This book is also the companion text to a recent public television series. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Randall Balmer is my guest, author of a book, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory. He also teaches religious history at Barnard College. In your travels around evangelical America, you came across one preacher named Brother Frisbee, Neil Frisbee, and he's a faith healer who also believes that the apocalypse is near. Since he's a faith healer, I don't know if you wanted to test him or just see what the experience would be like, but you went up to him and told him that you had a friend who was going deaf in one ear and who needed healing.
Yes, I did. He had made an announcement that he would heal people from afar as well. And as I went up to Brother Frisbee, I said, I have a friend who's recently lost the hearing in one ear. Would you heal her? And he said, is she close enough to come to the meetings, or is she far away? And I said, no, she was back in New York and couldn't come to the meetings. Well, okay, we'll heal her anyway, he said. And so Brother Frisbee grabbed me with a sweaty hand on my forehead and put his other hand on the back of my neck and unleashed this thunderous prayer, you know, kind of shaking me and bearing down with pressure on my forehead, and I'm sure I didn't respond entirely appropriately afterwards when I simply kind of reached out my hand and shook his and said, thank you.
Did you feel anything while that was happening?
I felt a sweaty palm on my forehead.
Did you feel very self-conscious?
Oh, I'm very self-conscious, obviously. I felt in some ways like an imposter, although that certainly wasn't my pretext for being there. And let me say that I don't dismiss the notion of divine healing. I don't pretend to understand it, and I certainly can't explain it in any scientific terms. But I must say that I've been moved and perhaps almost persuaded by accounts from people who have been healed by faith or through divine healing. And I find it difficult to refute that That's those statements.
So when you went up to Brother Frisbee and told him about your friend who needed healing, were you open to the possibility that maybe he could actually heal her?
Oh, sure. Sure. Now, I think if I asked Brother Frisbee about this, he would say that the reason that she hadn't been healed, and she wasn't, was that I didn't have sufficient faith, or that she didn't have sufficient faith. And this is a kind of a convenient alibi that I heard time and time again. Well, if the healing didn't take, then your faith is deficient.
You've looked at political activism within evangelicalism. And one of the points that you make is that homosexuality has become one of the issues at the top of the agenda. Why has it moved to the top?
I think it has to do with a couple of things. First of all, issues of sexuality are issues that, frankly, enchant us all or repel us all. They get our attention, and that's the part of the reason that the abortion debate has been so feverish in over the last decade or so. But now with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we've been casting about for new enemies. For a while, we fixed on Japan as the new enemy. Another new enemy for us is Hillary Rodham Clinton. For many members of the religious right, she is kind of the new demon. But I think the most compelling enemy for at least members of the religious right is the homosexual movement and gays and lesbians. And it gives evangelicals, gives the religious right a certain self-righteousness and self-confidence.
You think that evangelicals actually identify with the vulnerability of the fetus?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that's at least a theory that I've toyed around with over the years as a way of trying to explain, at least to myself, why it is that evangelicals have invested such peculiar passion into the abortion debate. Now, remember, I'm a historian, and what's curious about that, in part, is that when Roe v. Wade was announced, when the decision was handed down in 1973, you didn't find evangelicals rushing in saying, no, this is morally abominable, and so forth. It wasn't until late in the 1970s that they finally fixed on this issue of abortion. Again, the architects of the religious right, Paul Weyrich in particular, are emphatic about this, that what galvanized the religious right late in the 1970s was the case of the Justice Department going after Bob Jones University, a fundamentalist school in North Carolina, South Carolina, pardon me, on the issue of discrimination. That's what galvanized the religious right. And Weyrich says emphatically that it was only after we began to sense we had some political muscle that a few of us, that is Falwell, Tim LaHaye, and others, got on the phone and said, well, what are the other issues that we can express our views about? Somebody said abortion. And only then did abortion rise to the top or near the top of the religious rights agenda. I was trying to explain that, why it is that otherwise law-abiding citizens, for example, would be willing to be carted off to jail for their opposition to abortion. It doesn't seem to grow out of any abstract commitment to the sanctity of life, because many of the fundamentalists who would oppose abortion also would support capital punishment, although there is an argument I recognize, and I want to honor that, a distinction between innocent life and non-innocent life. But still, I don't think even that explains the kind of passion that evangelicals have invested into the abortion issue. And I began to think that given the history of evangelicalism in the 20th century in particular, that evangelicals in some visceral way really identified with the vulnerability of the fetus. One of the women that I interviewed on the campaign trail in 1988 in Iowa said, the most dangerous place to be these days is inside a mother's womb. And I think many evangelicals feel themselves endangered in American culture in much the same way. They feel like the outside world is trying to get them. There are all sorts of evil forces that they have to stave off in one way or another. And so I think the fetus for them is an important symbol, a symbol of their own vulnerability in a world that is evil and unrighteous and out of control.
In your book, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, you write that one of the reasons why you wanted to travel around the country looking at different evangelical churches and different evangelical preachers was that you wanted to reacquaint yourself with the revolutionary force of the evangelical gospel. What is that force?
I think the message of the New Testament is that humanity is in need of divine intervention. And through Jesus, we are given access to the grace of God. And God's grace is ineluctable. That is, it cannot be resisted. That, to me, I think, is the force of evangelicalism. It seems to me there are two elements in Martin Luther's rediscovery of the gospel in the 16th century. The first is that human nature is depraved and in need of salvation. The second is that God offers God's grace unconditionally. And it seems to me the great divide you see in American Protestantism in the 20th century between the liberals on the one hand, that is mainline Protestants, and evangelicals or fundamentalists on the other side, is that each side has not upheld both elements of that gospel. That is, the liberals emphasize God's grace without taking into account human depravity. The evangelicals emphasize human depravity without taking fully into account God's grace. And that, to me, is the tragedy of 20th century Protestantism.
You described your trip around America as a personal odyssey. You expected to be changed by it. How were you changed?
I was changed in that a lot of the preaching I heard, and especially the music that I heard, was evocative of my own past. I began to be rather nostalgic about my own past, the kind of simplicity of the religion that I was reared with. And in many ways, I missed that. The complexity of life and intellectual doubts that I've acquired over the years can sometimes be disconcerting. And so in that sense, I was changed. I was also changed, I think, by the people that I met. Again, I wanted to write the book to get away from this notion that the televangelists somehow equal evangelicals in America. That, I knew, as someone who grew up as an evangelical, was absolutely wrong. And so in the course of my travels, I became acquainted with hundreds of people who are salt-of-the-earth sort of people, people that you would love to have as neighbors, even though you might regard their views or their theology as a bit peculiar. They're wonderful people, and I was impressed by that again and again. These are the people whose faith really has sustained them during hard times, people with a lot of medical problems and illness, who are utterly convinced that God somehow has gotten them through the difficult times in their lives. And these are the people that I think changed me in many ways.
What kind of church do you belong to now?
I attend an Episcopal church here in New York City.
And what is it about the Episcopal church that made you feel like that was where you belonged?
Maybe because they don't have any applause on Sunday morning. I began attending an Episcopal church when I was in graduate school. In part, I think it probably was part of a rebellion against my past, against the kind of aesthetic deprivation that I'd felt growing up. I like the structure of the liturgy. The music, I think, is very often extraordinary. And that appeals to me a great deal. You don't have the cult of personality in a liturgical setting that you do in evangelicalism. And that, I think, is a good safeguard against the kind of abuses that can crop up within evangelicalism.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Randall Balmer is the author of Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory. He teaches at Barnard College. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Betsy Lieberman about building the first nursing home in this country designed specifically for people with AIDS. Lieberman is executive director of AIDS Housing of Washington in Washington State. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Love and Rutabaga, a memoir about growing up in German-occupied France by Claire Shu Accomando. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Milan, Italy, officials say at least five people were killed when a car bomb exploded in the center of the city. Police say up to 15 others have been injured. There are also reports of two explosions only minutes apart in Rome. In late May, a car bomb killed five people in Florence and damaged the famed Uffizi Museum. President Clinton continued meeting with Democratic lawmakers today as the House and Senate get closer to a compromise on his deficit reduction package. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The administration is working furiously to round up the votes it will need in the House and Senate to pass the plan. No Republican support is expected, and the White House is facing the same close vote it did when the original version of the budget squeaked through Congress this spring. Today, the president tried to squelch the latest idea from his on-again, off-again supporter in the Senate, Oklahoma Democrat David Boren. Boren has suggested a bipartisan budget summit to reconsider the deficit issue in the fall.
If you delay it a couple of months, you're going to have less deficit reduction, higher interest rates, more fragility and uncertainty in the economy, more consumer confidence going down. We have been working on this.
President Clinton said none of those issues can be dealt with until the budget is settled. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
IBM announced today it will eliminate another 35,000 jobs by the end of 1994 and cut its quarterly dividend in half. The company also said that it lost $8 billion during the first quarter of this year, largely because of the expense of its current downsizing efforts. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
These latest cuts bring to 85,000 the number of jobs eliminated from the IBM workforce this year alone. The company would not say where the cuts would take effect, but at a press conference this morning, Chairman Louis Gerstner said they would be more heavily weighted toward IBM operations overseas. The cuts come at a time of continuing financial difficulty for the world's largest computer company. It had operating losses of $40 million in the second quarter of 1992, but when the costs of downsizing, such as severance packages for departing employees, are included, the actual losses were $8 billion. Still, Gerstner told reporters that once these losses are absorbed, he believes the company will be back on the road to profitability. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The ACLU has gone to court in a challenge to President Clinton's policy on gays in the military. There are a number of pending federal court cases challenging the military's outright ban on gays and lesbians in the military that is superseded by the Clinton plan. The ACLU lawsuit says the Clinton policy violates the 14th Amendment. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 2 points to close at 3,565.46 on volume of 253 million shares. This is NPR News. Capitol Hill, the House has approved $3 billion for Midwest flood aid after delaying a controversy over how to pay for it. President Clinton says that he will ask for $1.1 billion extra. Procedural arguments had delayed the measure for 5 days. The bill passed in the House by a vote of 400-27 and now goes on to the Senate. Governors of 5 Midwestern states are in Washington to lobby Congress for aid for their flood-damaged areas. In Iowa alone, officials estimate flood damage will reach $3 billion. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
Flood-weary Iowans are desperate for the federal flood aid President Clinton promised, but so far all they see in Washington is politicians bickering over how to pay for it. President Clinton says he will ask Congress for $4.1 billion in flood aid, but Iowa Governor Terry Branstad's spokesman Dick Voss says that won't be enough.
We're not getting much encouragement. We're very concerned that there isn't much movement in Washington. There's been no movement on the waivers on the local governments and economy. There's been no change in the program so far.
Agriculture officials say in Iowa alone, crop losses and damaged fields will cost the state $700 million. Statewide, damage is estimated at $3 billion, a number that is sure to rise as water recedes. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
In Geneva, leaders of the three warring factions in Bosnia met today for their first direct talks on a plan to divide the country into three ethnic states. One of those taking part in the talks said that there had been some progress in the hour-and-a-half-long meeting. Another meeting is planned tomorrow in Geneva in efforts to end the 16 months of fighting in Bosnia. Up to 200,000 people are reported either dead or missing in the nation's civil war. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When we think of nursing homes, we think of facilities for the elderly. But the AIDS epidemic has left a much younger population in need of full-time care. My guest, Betsy Lieberman, is the executive director of AIDS Housing of Washington in Washington State, which oversaw the development of the first newly constructed nursing home in the country for people with AIDS. Located in Seattle, the Bailey Boucher House opened last summer. Lieberman is the co-author of the new book, Breaking New Ground. It's a resource guide to developing AIDS housing. In 1987, when she started planning Bailey Boucher, there was no capacity within the existing nursing system to deal with people with AIDS. Hospitals were also backed up and very expensive. There was a need for alternative long-term care. I asked her about some of the fears people with AIDS have about where they will spend the last weeks of their lives and where they will die.
Well, for most people with AIDS, they're people who are in the prime of their life when they get sick. They're primarily people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And so it's most people have not, in the United States, have not confronted issues of death and dying in our generation. And so it's really, most people want to die in their homes if they have a home and if they can afford to have the kind of care and support that they want. I mean, that's the universal choice for most people living with HIV/AIDS. But for many people, they don't have an appropriate home. They don't have the kind of support systems that they need in order to be able to die at home. For many people, they don't have insurance or the private means to pay for 24-hour round-the-clock care. So we really, the goal of Bailey Boucher House was to create a very home-like environment for people living with HIV/AIDS that they could choose whatever type of care they wanted. About 90% of the people who have lived at Bailey Boucher in the first year have ended up dying at Bailey Boucher House, but 10% have gone back to the community to live and receive other kinds of treatment. So it's really geared and oriented to people receiving whatever types of long-term care services they want and they need.
I know one of the things you did when you were planning the AIDS care facility was to organize focus groups of people with AIDS and ask them what they'd want in such a facility. What were some of the things you came up with?
Well, it was very interesting because I went into this planning process with a bias myself. I come out of a public health background, and I went into the planning thinking, oh, everyone must want hospice care because that's what I would want. And I discovered in talking to many people with AIDS, one is most people wanted to stay at home, as I said earlier, if they could do that. The secondly is very few people were saying, I actively choose hospice care. I mean, hospice care in this country means that you only are choosing palliative treatment, treatment for pain and support to help you die. And many, many people with HIV/AIDS are still choosing to receive antibiotics or AZT up until the end of life. And
well, I guess there's a reason for that. I mean, but with people with AIDS, one illness will come close to killing you, and then that bug will be killed, and then you kind of spring back for a while.
Right. We had a board member who died just this past spring who had had AIDS for almost 5 years, who was an inspiration to me. And on two different occasions, I visited him in the intensive care unit of the VA hospital in Seattle and said goodbye to him. And then 2 weeks later, he was back at home, and then a month later, he was back at the gym. Mm-hmm. And so it just sort of puts the epidemic into perspective, the whole fluctuating care nature for people with AIDS. The first floor of Bailey Boucher House is actually a day health program for people with HIV/AIDS who live in the community, who need care and support during the daytime. And it's really been an effective way to support people to stay at home and also give some relief to caregivers.
Do you have people at this AIDS facility who go in and out of the hospital if a condition gets really bad and they need intensive care help, for instance?
Occasionally people go into the hospital. It's not the norm. I mean, the Bailey Boucher House has, as compared to a standard geriatric nursing home where they have about just less than 3 nursing hours per resident per day, Bailey Boucher House has closer to 7 direct nursing hours, so that people can get a very high level of what you're calling intensive nursing care, which is mostly what's done at Bailey Boucher House. And so it rarely warrants people going back to the hospital unless they choose to. You know, occasionally, I mean, Bailey Boucher House doesn't do surgery, and there's no ability to do things like high-tech CAT scans, but people can get all sorts of chemotherapies there. They can have blood transfusions there. And so there's been very few transfers to the hospital since the 13 months since it opened.
My guest is Betsy Lieberman, Director of AIDS Housing of Washington. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Betsy Lieberman, co-author of a new book on developing AIDS housing. The Bailey Boucher House is the first nursing care facility designed from scratch for people with AIDS.
Right.
So since you had the ability to start from scratch and just design it for people with AIDS, what did you do that's different from other nursing care facilities?
Well, for one thing is we involved the community in the planning of the project. I mean, we involve people with AIDS, people involved in AIDS services, the major hospitals, in thinking about what we need. And then because Seattle's what's called a second wave city in the AIDS epidemic, we're about 3 years behind cities like San Francisco and New York and Los Angeles in terms of the epidemic. We involved people who ran hospices and long-term care facilities in other communities in the planning of the project. And then so we looked at the care needs. The standard length of stay in a nursing home in this community for an older adult is about 24 months. The standard length of stay at Bailey Boucher House is about 6 weeks. And so we were looking at a much more, you know, compacting the amount of time that people would stay in Bailey Boucher House. One of the things that we did that was, you know, probably one of the biggest decisions that we made was to have private bedrooms, that we felt like both from a care issue, the fact that people's immune systems were already compromised, and also the fact that, you know, people really wanted to involve their families, their support systems, their partners in their care, that private rooms were much more conducive to this. The room has a sofa in it, and someone's partner or family member can stay over. The other thing we chose to do was put, there's a bathroom in each room, so a person has access to a toilet and a sink. And for many people with HIV/AIDS, issues of incontinence and bowel dysfunction really come at the latter stages of the illness. And so having that level of control and dignity and being able to use your own bathroom made a big difference. We also did a number of small things. Each room has its own thermostat so that the resident can control the heat or the air conditioning. The windows are operable, so someone can, you know, choose to let fresh air in. Each room has a telephone. These are very small things, but people can call out when they need to. Rooms have a television and VCR. There's a bulletin board in the bedroom, so people can tack up anything they want. There's these very nice picture rails, so people can hang up their own artwork. I mean, we try to look at, you know, very small things you could do that just make the facility a lot more humane and livable.
I think you once estimated that there's a death about every 30 hours
right
at the house. So what happens when somebody dies? Does everybody know about it? Is there any kind of observance of the death, or does everybody just try to go on kind of like nothing happened?
There's a full-time person at Bailey Boucher House who does staff development and coordinates staff support. So there's sort of the tension between the facility has a huge waiting list, and so the pressure is on to move someone out of a room and have the room available for another person with HIV/AIDS in this community, and balancing that with making sure that the family, the friends, the staff have the ability to sort of deal with the death. There's memorial services that go on very frequently at the facility. There's a monthly service and weekly support groups to just acknowledge people's death. There's a wonderful meditation room that if you go in there, you see little treasures. There's an immobile with people's, little remembrances to people. There's photographs all over the facility and artwork all over the facility. So people, there's really an acknowledgement that, it's important to acknowledge the people's dying as much as it is important to acknowledge people's birth.
There's a growing problem with tuberculosis. I don't know if you've had to deal with that yet.
Uh-huh. Well, we have had to deal with that in Bailey Boucher House. The fortunate thing, we knew about TB and HIV. I mean, it was just beginning to impact the HIV epidemic when we started the planning for Bailey Boucher House. And the facility is able to accommodate people with active tuberculosis. There's 4 isolation rooms that, though it's sort of funny to have isolation rooms in a facility with private bedrooms, but there are 4 rooms that have 6 air exchanges per hour that vent directly to the out of doors that can accommodate people with active tuberculosis. Unfortunately, in most other AIDS housing projects across the country where they remodeled existing houses or existing apartment buildings, they were not able to accommodate. The mechanical systems are not able to accommodate people with active tuberculosis, and it's become an increasing problem, particularly in places like New York and Philadelphia, where you are, and in Miami, where they're starting to see tuberculosis in epidemic proportions.
I want to get back to the design of the interior. I know you're trying to keep things as warm and comfortable and home-like as possible. On the other hand, you're really trying to accommodate some of the special needs of people with AIDS, such as incontinence. So I think a lot of the furniture is like vinyl, something that's easily washable. The rugs are of a weave that is easily washable. Is there a conflict that you have to walk there between, the kind of comfort and warmth that you want and the kind of health protection that you need?
It would be great if you could see what the facility looks like in the radio. But that tension was incredibly present. And, a lot of the people with HIV in this community would have loved to have cotton furniture that had cotton covers. And so we really struggled with how do we do exactly what you said. How do we make something clean, cleanable and durable as well as look residential? So the compromise we worked out is the seats of most of the chairs are vinyl, or what's called in the design industry polyolefin, which is a petroleum product that's very cleanable. And then a number of the fabric designers in the Northwest actually gave us at cost some beautiful fabrics. So what we did is we put vinyl on the seats and the fabrics on the backs. And so the chairs, you know, they look warmer and more residential, but the seats are very cleanable and durable. But we struggled a lot around the picking of fabrics and the choosing of furniture and chairs. I mean, we went as far as the facility has a lot of these very, very nice stacking straight back chairs that are in the dining rooms and in some of the resident rooms. And we got a whole different assortment of chairs together and got many people with HIV/AIDS together and had them try the chairs and tell us which ones were the most comfortable.
Do you need to be wealthy to stay at an AIDS care facility?
It's a good question. Most of the patients at Bailey Boucher House are funded either through Medicaid or Medicare or some private insurance. And throughout all the housing for people with HIV/AIDS in the United States, most of the housing is primarily for people with limited resources. Most of the people at Bailey Boucher House, as with most of the other AIDS housing in the United States, are living on what's called Social Security disability, meaning they're disabled by HIV/AIDS. And the amount of money they get ranges anywhere from $350 to about $600 a month. So it's almost none of the AIDS housing is at all economically driven. In most housing projects, people pay a third of their income for rent, which is a standard kind of rent that HUD charges in most of its projects.
You're the director of the AIDS Housing Project of mm-hmm. Washington. What do you do when you have a friend or a friend of a friend who has AIDS and says, you've got to get me into one of these care facilities? Pull strings for me. Do something.
That's really hard. I mean, I encourage people I know who have HIV/AIDS to get on the waiting lists early. Because we don't, even though Seattle has a whole continuum of housing for people with AIDS, we don't even meet 50% of the housing need in this community. And in other cities, it's a lot worse. So I encourage people not to wait till there's a crisis in their life. It's the same words of encouragement I give to older adults is, you know, don't wait till you are too sick to get into a residential care facility. Really think about try and put this into perspective. But it's hard. I mean, people don't want to move until it becomes a real crisis. And there's not a mechanism. Bailey Boucher House, which is licensed by the state of Washington, does not allow you to discriminate in your waiting lists. So it's really, you get on the waiting list, and then when your name comes up, that's your chance to move in, unfortunately.
Betsy, have you lost a lot of friends to AIDS?
I have lost a lot of friends to AIDS. I mean, it's been really difficult. We've lost a lot of board members to AIDS. I mean, all of our original founding board members who had HIV/AIDS have died since the beginning of the development of AIDS Housing of Washington in 1988, and that was really tragic to me. I mean, for many of them, the facility wasn't even finished in time for them to use it.
Betsy Lieberman is the author of Breaking New Ground. She directs AIDS Housing of Washington in Seattle. She's coordinating the first national conference on housing for people with AIDS to be held this September in Chicago. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, a lot of business stories in the news.
Yes, very big layoffs announced by IBM today. Also, a congressional-appointed commission looking into the S&L crisis makes its recommendations, including a restructuring of the whole thrift industry in America. And the International Trade Commission agrees to sustain tariffs against a lot of steel imported into this country from abroad. Also, we'll have news of more Israeli strikes in southern Lebanon. And the president meets with Midwestern governors about the floods.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As news photos from places like Bosnia and Somalia remind us, children are often the victims of war, yet they rarely have the opportunity to describe their experiences. But in a new memoir entitled Love and Rutabaga, a grown-up child of war recalls what it was like to be 5 years old when the German army marched into Paris and turned her world upside down. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
I almost didn't read Love and Rutabaga because of its title. I thought, with such a silly title, how good can the book be? Usually, even mediocre books try to have poetic or grandiose titles, like, for instance, The Last Days of Pompeii, that Victorian snoozer by Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton. But Love and Rutabaga is one of those rare cases in literature where a title undersells the power of the story it introduces. Claire Sue A Commando vividly resurrects her childhood view of the world in this memoir. To the little girl Claire, love and the vile vegetable rutabaga were the two most essential things because they sustained her and her family throughout the war years in German-occupied France. By the time I finished this memoir, I thought the rutabaga not only deserved its place in the title, but probably even deserved the Medal of Valor. A Commando was the daughter of a French mother and a Chinese father, a diplomat who was trapped in Russia during the war. Claire, her baby brother, and her pregnant mother left Paris in the fall of 1941 and went to live with her grandparents in the south of France. It's easy to see why the events and people of that time would continue to be so fresh for A Commando even now, some 50 years later. For mixed in with the common memories of early childhood are some uncommon images. There are fleeting glimpses here of A Commando's mother, her body swollen with pregnancy, riding off on her bicycle to carry messages for the resistance. There are loving pictures of her grandmother, a concert pianist, who was determined to give Claire piano lessons even as the war ripped their home apart. And there are comic descriptions of the French villagers gathering for covert English lessons. Nobody can pronounce Eisenhower, so they practice saying, "Welcome, Ike," to greet the American soldiers. You might expect it would be jarring to have a pint-sized narrator telling you about sabotage, sacrifice, and death. But the child Claire's voice, so full of bewildered fascination, turns out to be just the right voice for conveying the chaos of war. And watching scenes unfold here through a child's eyes adds to their suspense. One evening, some village girls arrive at the grandparents' house looking for costumes for the parish play. They're really there to smuggle a contraband radio out from under the eyes of German soldiers who are also living in the house. Claire itches to remind the adults that the parish play has been canceled. And since we readers see things through her perspective, we fidget right along with her. But we're also petrified because we know something the child Claire doesn't, that the results will be tragic if she speaks. Luckily, a stern look from the adults seals Claire's loose lips. In several passages, A Commando recalls a melancholy phrase of her grandmother's, something about the cruelty of objects that survive long after their owners. This wartime memoir is filled with images of such cruel objects, but reading Love and Rutabaga will make you feel thankful that books also survive the people and times that have long since vanished.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Love and Rutabaga. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He cleans houses by day. He writes at night. On the next Fresh Air, we meet David Sedaris. He's been reading his journals on NPR's Morning Edition about his job as an elf in Santaland, why he won't stop smoking, and how he almost wrote for a magazine catering to men who like giant-sized women. He's a real original. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.